The pyramid doesn't work. We've already tried it.
It's upside down.
What?
Sir, the pyramid is upside down.
Turn the pyramid upside down. You can't be serious. That would put butter and fat at the top
Flip the damn food pyramid!
Get the prisoner on the phone. Tell him to have some steak with his butter. The pyramid...
All right, so...
And it actually happened.
It actually happened. I really like unorthodox thinkers. I like people who are bringing together ideas in lots of areas. You have folks that are talking about, you know, everything from, you know, mental health to politics to culture and science and all these places. And today we have a guest that has been doing this on the politics and culture of diet and the environment, and his book, Sacred Cow. It's been out for about a year now, right?
June of COVID, which murdered the release.
But I read it, really dug it, and it is a really interesting combination of these. We have Rob Wolf on the program with us today. We're really excited to have you.
Absolutely. Huge honor to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Just so folks know, in case some of our listeners aren't totally familiar with you, you're a two-time Wall Street Journal and New York Times bestselling author of The Paleo Solution and Wired to Eat. You are the co-founder, as I understand, of the first and fourth CrossFit Correct. Affiliate gyms in the world.
In the world.
That's fantastic.
Not just down the street.
And you are the host of the Healthy Rebellion Radio, which is a great podcast. I listen to it. You guys should definitely go check it out if you haven't. And of course, founder of the now legendary hydration brand, Element.
Yep.
Thanks for being here, Rob.
Yeah, huge honor to be here. Yeah.
Thank you for
I don't
bringing
get to do up. Live stuff very often. We usually live in the back country. So, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. You moved to the mountains of Montana. How long ago now?
So we hit Kalispell 6 years ago, five and a half, 6 years ago, 3 years there, and then we're coming up on 3 years here because
awesome.
We moved the HQ for Element to Bozeman.
What was the why'd you do that?
James, our CEO, he left New York during COVID, and his family had been in Big Sky for quite some time. And it's really interesting. Our greatest per capita usage of Element is in the Mountain West and Montana specifically. It's
really?
Kind of weird. I think it's some of the jujitsu relationships that we have around here, but we just have a lot of traction with this. And both James and I kind of either want to be at the beach or the mountains. And in a lot of ways, I would kind of pick the mountains and then go to the beach. You know?
Right,
so,
exactly.
Yeah. And we've just over time been incentivizing more and more of the team to move this direction. And out of a 45-person team, I think full-time now, we have 12, 15 people, and then maybe about 8 to 10 other people that will rotate in at a pretty consistent cadence. And then we do a three-on-one-off work schedule where we work like crazy for 3 weeks, have 1 week more or less off for, we call it rest and assess. You kind of look back at what you've did, look forward to what you want to do. The second week of each month, usually the whole team comes to Bozeman and we get together. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
I really like that culture. Three weeks on, 1 week off. That's really cool. Well,
you can't sprint and marathon both. You could sprint a marathon. You can do it in sprint intervals. And early on, we had some people that got really cooked. My wife was a co-founder of a tech startup. And within that tech startup, they had four suicides, which is a pretty under-described thing within startups. Like people just get fucking annihilated, you know, from the work schedule. And so early on, we kind of applied some biological practices to this. It's kind of like, you know, humans do really well in interval-based stuff. You think about like Pomodoros with learning, like you study really hard for 20 minutes and then take a break. And that intensity is really where the best work is done. And you can't have intensity all the time.
True.
And so do you want mediocre work where people are ground down to a nub, or do you want like their absolute A game, best work? If you want that, then you've got to give them some time. Like the greater the highs, the greater the lows, you've got to plug into that. And so, you know, knock on wood, that's worked for us so far. Not every business can do that. A restaurant, I don't know how you do that.
Right,
there's a lot of stuff. I don't know how you do that. But yeah, that's been some of the, I think some of the secret sauce with the success that we've had. So we have a small team relative to the volume of stuff that we do, but we get a lot out of those folks. But I think that we're not like totally murdering them along the way.
That's really cool.
Super important.
Yeah. Well, and I like about that because it's very integrative to your philosophy, as I understand it, that a lot of modern society isn't really compatible with our genetics.
Yeah.
And if we can program it that way, we find better integration with, you know, our health, with our well-being. And then you're putting that into your business,
yeah.
Which the business itself is about selling healthy drinks.
And the we had this kind of wacky idea that like we maybe should have a healthy team if we're promoting health.
That is such a novel thought.
That's great.
That's really true. That's really true. Well, and speaking of, you know, genetics, what's healthy and what's good for people, how are you feeling about this new food pyramid that was just introduced?
It's really honestly pretty cool. A friend of mine, Nina Teicholz, has been pushing to get some revamping of the food pyramid for 12 years, 15 years, and God bless her for doing it. I tend to just kind of try to end run around things. Like, I don't go to the establishment. Being early in CrossFit and paleo and all that stuff, I just notice that there's lots of options for changing the things that need changing, but not going to the gatekeepers and trying to do that. Nina, by contrast, has just been hammering tongs on this stuff for ages. And lo and behold, like we actually got a real shift on this stuff. What's fascinating will be, what does this really mean in practice? Like, is the 40 years of indoctrination within nutritional science and dietitians, is that going to change anything? Like, or are they like, now that this is the rule of the land, historically, they've said, well, these are the guidelines, so we have to follow them. Right. I really get this sense a lot of them are kind of like, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep doing what we were doing previously. But it at least, it is a change. Like, that's a pretty big deal that just at a governmental level that we have an, I mean, there's no way you can look at that thing and not have a win. Like, there's actual food at the base, you know, the preponderance of this thing. You could run it through a nutrition analyzer. You compare a very grain heavy 2000 calorie diet with this, you know, protein, fruits, veggies, you know, is kind of the root. And you run them side by side in nutrition analyzer and you get more vitamins, minerals, antioxidants with this new version than you did with the old version. And then if you look at satiety indexes, this is a more satiating diet. You're less likely to overeat eating this way than you would with the other one. So if we can enact this, it should get some momentum going in a favorable direction.
At least it'll give some cover maybe to some of those dietitians or folks in the nutrition space who have been thinking this way, but would have to be too unorthodox for their institution or whatever it might be. It could give them a little bit of cover fire.
Right? Gives them a 5-year window to try to get some shit done.
Right.
I predict that it's going to break down to ideological lines. You're going to have kind of liberal doctors being like, no, that's the new propaganda coming from the administration. It's big dairy.
Eat or more bread. Like that, you
know? I mean, and then you're going to have folks who are going to, you know, what this is really beneficial to is it puts that institutional support behind the idea.
Yeah.
And that's got to be a huge win. In terms of the institutions are ultimately where we fall back on when we aren't doing the education ourselves, right? The people who have been on this so far, like my story, and I've heard your story and so many others, has been, I had a health problem and then I had to go out and I had to go look at heterodox at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was like 2012, 2013 to find answers about why I was feeling bad, and why I couldn't get the health goals I was going for.
Yeah.
And now it's going to be, well, the first thing you see, hopefully, if you're a kid coming up today or you're getting to that age where all of a sudden you can't eat anything, it doesn't affect you anymore, you know, that early 20s kind of time frame, this is going to be maybe the first thing you see. And that could lead a margin of people leading in a better direction.
Yeah. What a fascinating opportunity is, I've argued for ages that we should have 5 different American medical associations. And although I hate insurance, and insurance is supposed to be for a rainy day, not for like trying to make every single thing that you consume within medicine and healthcare free. Mm-hmm. Like it should be a cash and carry thing for 99% of stuff. You get hit by a bus, get cancer, then you've got a catastrophic plan to deal with that. But I would love for there to be 5 different American medical associations, 5 different dietary interventions, and compete those things against each other. Mm-hmm. Let's see which one wins. And instead of one monolithic entity, that this is the rule of the land, and maybe it's right, but if it's not, then literally the whole system is is wrong and broken. And not to drive this off into the political realm too quickly, but oddly enough, Bill Clinton did a fascinating thing with his welfare reform ages ago, where he kicked it all back to the states, and he had the states for a four-year period basically implement what their view of welfare was. And some of it was awful, and some of it was actually pretty good. And then they looked at best practices, brought that back up to the federal level. And although things have drifted over time, there was a marked improvement, like work programs and getting trying to figure out ways of keeping people on welfare for as brief a period as you could. A safety net, but not something that encumbers them for multiple generations. And I think whenever you can get a multi-pronged experiment going on, running in parallel, we can figure out a lot more truth. And maybe some things work for some populations better than others. But if you only have one go at it, you will never know that. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of interesting opportunities that will emerge. Yeah,
just got to make sure welfare isn't Minnesota. Or no,
right. Well, again, let's compare it there and see what it delivers.
Yeah,
exactly.
True. Well, the attention there is going to bring attention to other states. Like we're discovering stuff in Washington now. We're discovering stuff in other states, Maine, based upon the Minnesota.
I've been seeing a lot of Massachusetts, my home state.
Yeah. Right. So you have all of those, and then you have the same lack of accountability in diet as long as, like, the American Medical Association, as a government-sponsored monopoly, is hidden to the general public. People don't know that during the Progressive Era, they were like, wow, there's all this snake oil medicine, so we're going to implement one organization to be the standard for all health, call it the American Medical Association. A trade union was given monopoly rights, and that's how one of the reasons why we wound up in the situation we're in, where there's only one set of guidance for these things. And so people think, well, it's the objectively right one. And that's that hubris, that faith that we can just get to the truth if we just put enough experts in charge.
Right.
Which was totally exposed during COVID, right? During COVID, mm-hmm. we had all the experts say the same thing. Well, I mean, don't wear a mask. Well, do wear a mask.
Yeah, it depends on which day we're talking.
the only way you can get coverage from the virus was if you got the vaccine. Oh, it's not if you got infected. You know, all those kind of changes were demonstrative of the scientific process as we learned more. Or based upon the politics, because once you monopolize something, it becomes a political organization. Once you put the government ahead of it and say the government's going to tell you what's the right thing in health, then they're going to make that decision based upon political interests. And that's always the thing about the old school food pyramid that always drove me crazy, was the degree to which, and I'm not sure, I haven't done the full research on this, but to what degree it was influenced by the grain lobby. And influenced by agricultural subsidies in the heartland area that we were growing a lot of grains.
We touched on this a bit in Sacred Cow. And Nixon is an interesting character because he took us off the gold standard. Mm-hmm. And he also, when he was facing re-election, he needed a large conservative base to cater to. And he reinstated a ton of subsidies for farm, you know, basically farm subsidies that had been sunset after World War II, and he kind of spun those things back up. They were on the books. And not long after that, we started experiencing these huge gluts of food. Like, they were literally just like throwing away cheese and milk and grains and whatnot, because we had this massive glut of food. This is where some of the government food programs came from, but it also was the beginning of what we would call the junk food industry, because you had this government subsidized inputs of raw materials that were incredibly inexpensive, you know, indifferent. It's kind of like this stuff's just so cheap that we have to figure out interesting things to do with it. And so that it's kind of interesting. Like usually it's hard, either because I'm crazy or whatever, but to tie in like the decoupling of our fiat currency system with the healthcare system and how that was the beginning of a lot of really bad stuff. But if you don't understand, maybe that's right, maybe it's wrong, but if it's correct and literally nobody knows about it, then all the things we're doing to try to address it are just pissing into the wind, because you're not dealing with the root cause stuff.
Absolutely. And it's so funny that you bring up that connection, because I feel like everything in that's wrong in the United States can be traced back to our decoupling from sound money.
Yeah.
And I was like, but what's the connection with the food system? And that's, there it is. It was all under Nixon.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was literally the same year, 1971. So, and this is where you go back and you start looking at when did like earnings per hour start degrading? 1971, when did people start getting fatter and sicker, when did autism and all this stuff start exploding? It was right around these times that the major inflection points in health, economics, and whatnot all occurred at the same time.
It's crazy. There's a great website called WTF Happened 1971.com. It is such a great website because you see this. Yeah, you're what you're saying, hourly compensation, net productivity separates in this major way in 1971. You look at real GDP per capita. You have income gains and by percentile.
I didn't even know this
income growth.
This site existed.
Yeah.
This is awesome.
Oh yeah.
This monetary is nerd that stuff. David is.
I just look at graphs a lot.
This makes me feel slightly less crazy.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And it's like there's a website that backs all of my insanity.
Yeah. The Gini. So this is measuring income inequality.
Oh yeah.
Look at that. Right. It's actually going down prior to that.
And because we should have had deflationary pressures, it makes the, you know, Moore's Law, all that stuff makes things cheaper and better. And if you have a sound currency, that's okay. If you have a fiat currency based off of debt, then that's a death spiral, which is,
And a lot of it's that low interest rates, interest rates that are below market percent incentivizes debt and not saving and short-term consumption. And just imagine when you're thinking about, oh, I just need to get calories in. Calories in is all that matters. Right now is all that matters. We're going to solve the problem right now. And the problem right now is we have too much agricultural products. So we need to rework the food pyramid and pressure people to have more grains for the benefit of the agricultural lobby. That short-term thinking is the part of the problem. And it's difficult to know how deep that interest for short-term thinking goes to the point where, you know, in 1971, I'm sure people on welfare probably had problems, but it probably wasn't obesity. Diabetes and obesity is one of the biggest problems amongst the poorest people in the country.
Right.
Yeah.
Now that is one of the defining features of poverty is this weird metabolic state of being overfed but undernutritioned. Mm. Like you're nutrient deficient but overfed to the tune that you have diabetic, diabetes type state. And that's one of the defining factors of poverty at this point, which is ironic, whereas poverty pre that period was you were malnourished. You were starving.
So go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna ask. I mean, we hear so much about how expensive it is to eat healthy. Do you really think that it is? Like, if you were to look at the landscape, is it because the people are poor that they have to eat these low quality subsidized foods? Is there a way to get out of that, or are they kind of trapped there?
It's complex. And Joel Salatin is the person that put this on my radar the first time. There was a point where people spent about 20% of income on healthcare and about 5% of income on food. And then that, or the opposite, it was 20% on food, 5% on healthcare.
Oh, yeah.
And that has switched. Mm-hmm. So we just did a one-for-one swap. And one would probably argue that now, with the subsidies that go into healthcare and the third-party payer system and, you know, the cost just spiraling out of control, that probably gets worse and worse. So if you factor real earnings decreasing, real purchasing power decreasing, then it is harder to eat well. Mm-hmm. And also, I made this point. I don't know if it made it into the book or maybe it was in the film. Like, if you go into a 7-Eleven, my second book, Wired Eat, really talked about the neuroregulation of appetite and like the we're wired for seeking as much novelty in our food as we can possibly get. And then we get bored of things, which is good because there's potential nutrient deficiencies if you eat only one thing. There's toxicity that could occur. So we're really wired up to seek as wide a variety of foods as you could. Any person, the poorest of the poor, goes into a 7-Eleven, they have more palate options than like any, you know, Pharaoh of Egypt, King of England had until 1980 or something. Yeah. So the poorest of the poor can go in and have this like palate experience and these flavor experiences that are really incredible. They are inexpensive and they're kind of addictive. And it's oftentimes one of the only things that people have really over control in their lives. Mm. They're like, my job sucks, I'm poor, I'm marginalized, you know, all these things. And then they can go in and have this meal. And again, I'm just saying 7-Eleven, but it's kind of like any kind of junk foodie type thing that's comparatively inexpensive. You get a bunch of calories out of it and you feel good for a little while. It spins the dopamine signals in the brain. You feel pretty good. Mm-hmm. And it is arguably somewhat more difficult to eat healthfully. But, you know, if we flip this stuff around, like I remember I want to post this at some point. When my wife and I were getting the fourth CrossFit affiliate gym up and going, we worked part-time in the gym, part-time as physical therapy aides. For 2 years, we as a combined household made less than $10,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And we had a $400 a month apartment. We had two cars that fortunately nothing broke on them during that 2 year period. But like I posted some blog posts then where I would go to like a Food for Less or something like that. Cheap ground beef, cabbage, onions, you know, you can eat on the cheaper side, but you then have the labor and the time costs of cooking food, which if people are, you know, single mom living at the margins, three kids to feed or something like that, like it's hard. Like it's legitimately hard to cook, you know, fresh meals. That is the way that you make this stuff cheaper, but it doesn't taste as good as like a, you know, Hot Pocket or something like that. It's not as easy, not as quick, doesn't give you that immediate gratification. So it can be done, but it's hard. Like there's the time costs associated with it, just knowing how to cook. Tons of people, particularly younger folks, don't know how to cook. Yeah. When you look at my wife and me, you're kind of like, what bet did she lose to marry that guy? She's actually like pretty good looking and smart and everything. And when she met me, there were five women for every one guy at Chico State, and I really knew how to cook well. So she was like, oh, okay, this sucks, but you know, this is probably the cleanest dirty shirt we got going on.
Oh, heck no.
Well, I feel like I had the same experience, and I just got out of college. I was way out of shape after doing all the college stuff, and you know, you just. I got a picture of myself like playing with my dog with my shirt off in the summertime. And I was like, oh, what is wrong with me? What happened? I was like a high school athlete. What happened to me? You know? And so I was like, we're going to figure something out. I found Mark Sisson's book on the paleo diet. And we started that. I was making, $10,000 a year between the two of us. I mean, we lived in World War II housing, like literally housing built for World War II soldiers returning. Yeah. It was like one room was like our office here. Like that was how big it was.
Wow.
And we were able to make it work. We were able to make it work by buying a cow. It had a little bit of upfront cost, but we had a freezer. And this is Montana, so everyone has lots of freezers. You can get freezers cheap, you know, freezing a bunch of cow meat and just making it in mass. No time to do anything. We didn't have kids at the time, so it wasn't too bad for that. And she's a good cook. But, you know, when you're young, it's difficult to make those decisions. But just like getting out of poverty, there's a certain set of rules set that if you follow, it generally does lead you out of poverty as you get older. If you don't have kids before you're married, probably not going to be poor as someone who does. If you graduate high school, you know, if you can stick with a 9-to-5 job with good soft skills, you'll probably find yourself a way out of poverty over time. That's what the data tells us. And it's kind of true for diet too. If you take ownership of it and you consciously do something about it rather than just kind of falling into the baseline programming, you're more likely to find yourself in a healthier situation.
Yeah. So it's more of a responsibility question there of how much do you care? How much are you going to take ownership of it? Mm-hmm. I guess my question is, you know, obviously we found ourselves so far down this path, right? Where people are kind of so far into this downward spiral from a medical health nutrition perspective. And this is a tough one for me to grapple with because I see what Bobby Kennedy is doing with Maha, and I see, you know, like the ban on some food dyes, and I see like some of these sort of top down, non-libertarian, non-aligned with my values kind of decisions. To what degree do you feel like, you know, that stuff is necessary at this point? And like, how would you kind of grade the Maha movement as it's been enacted so far through the Trump administration?
Oh man, that's a great question. First, I want to couch something like early on, and I mean, I guess this was the run-up to the last presidential election. Kennedy was in the running for a while, Vivek Ramaswamy. Like there were some other people in there that I was excited about. And I expressed some excitement around Kennedy. And my God, the amount of like negative emails that came into the Element CX was off the chain.
Really?
Just people so angry. And I just want to preface that with, I've been doing this stuff for 28 years, and I'm not saying I'm right, but like I've been in it. So it's not like I'm a Johnny come lately. You know, I've written two New York Times bestselling books on this stuff, been in the thick of it. I'm on the board of directors of a medical risk assessment program that did a intervention for the city of Reno that saved them $22 million prorated over a 10-year period, 33-to-1 return on investment. Like,
wow.
I've been in this and in the regenerative ag scene. So I'm aware of the problems with like the metabolic health issues, soil, regenerative ag. Like, and again, I'm not saying I'm right. Like, I'm not pulling the credentialed expertise card, but I'm also not wholly ignorant of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And when Kennedy popped up on my radar more prominently, he talked at length about metabolic health. He had an understanding of regenerative agriculture, the need for soil health. And I never thought in my life I would see a prominent political figure talk about that. Mm. So I had hope. I just fucking had hope.
How dare you?
And how dare I? I mean, these people were
pessimistic.
So these people were so mad at me because, and it's usually because of Kennedy's stance on vaccines. Like that's usually the delineator. Yeah. And I would try to have some interaction with these folks where it's like, hey, can we compartmentalize that? If you don't like that or that's something we need to fight over, cool. But can we compartmentalize that away from a bunch of this other stuff? And it's been really difficult. So like, I had really high hopes for where this was all going to go. I think they've generally done a good job. I think that the focus on like food dyes and natural flavors, I think is misguided, if I'm honest, for the most part. I think that that's kind of majoring in the minors, but it also may be a deal where it's kind of some base hit stuff. Like you just got to get some momentum.
Yeah.
And maybe those were some of the things that started leading into being able to get some action like this. I think I'm similar to you in that I get nervous whenever the government starts banning this or banning that. And my wife, again, being smarter than I am, she pointed out, she's Italian, and she said, Italy bans all kinds of shit. Like, they have much higher standards there. And when we go to Italy, I feel better. I am healthier in Italy when I eat there, and I eat more carbs, and I eat a wider variety of food, and I am empirically across the board healthier. But Italy and France and some places like that that have had, you know, potentially some kind of onerous legislation around these topics, they had a food culture that was really legit. American food culture is kind of a weird thing. Like American cheese, like our food culture is like mass produced shit. And so the scary thing for me, like I you need a good baseline, and this is where like a paleo approach or something, if we're throwing darts, it at least gets you about 85% to the bullseye. You know, like a basic Italian approach to eating, the emphasis on quality and time spent with family and all these types of things, that's 85% to the bullseye. The scary thing, I think, in part, is that when you start legislating things like maybe butter and meat go away, like they were really pushing for that. I know you have another clip that, you know, from the World Health Organization where they were recommending that you don't eat more than like a 35-gram, which is about this big around piece of red meat a week, you know. And Diana Rogers in her book analyzed that. And when you implement the Eat Lancet World Health Organization recommendations, you are guaranteed to be nutrient deficient, to overeat, because if you don't get the protein leverage hypothesis, if you don't get enough protein, you tend to just keep eating food until you get enough protein. And this is where folks have a tendency to overeat due to nutrient deficiency. So I think Kennedy has a good understanding of most everything within that. I think it is, I think we discover that it's harder to turn the ship on this stuff than what anybody would think. I think that my expectations were so high that if I'm really objective, they've actually done great work. It's really easy to criticize them. And I've just been reflecting on this the last couple of days. They've actually done a lot of really good work. I don't agree with all of it. But he's also a guy that I forget what the topic was. He had kind of thrown something out about some topic. Bunch of people gave him information. He's like, OK, I'll change my mind on this. And I was like, oh, my God, a political figure that changes their mind based off of data, you know.
Yeah,
and so, it really is literally unheard of. And I would just challenge people, look up the previous four or five secretaries of Health and Human Services, look at them, and then look at what they did. And just do a compare and contrast and like, do you want more of that or do you at least want something here?
Yeah.
And if at the edges, again, like the vaccine topic, I have a very – I'm pretty set in where I am. I could be, you know, maybe have my mind changed. But if that, for many people, I think that that's like a single topic, like kind of voting break. You're typically on one side or the other of it. But when we're talking about a complex topic like all of this health, maybe you don't like that piece, but can you like keep that in your head, not like it, fight against it if you don't like what he's talking about on the vaccine thing, but then can we assess these other things on their individual merit?
Right.
And I've just found very few people capable of doing that. They just write him and the whole movement off a whole cloth because they're typically on the like you know very pro vaccine side.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And that is super unfortunate. I agree. And I have instances of that all over in my life where people won't even talk to me about these issues. They won't even appreciate the fact that maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago, they would be shouting this sort of stuff, the nutrition stuff from the rooftops, and now they can't even talk about it.
It's been funny. Tons of people that are like the paleo chick or the keto gal, but they're really on a different side of the aisle than I am on the vaccine side, and they hate everything that he and Maha is doing around the food side now. Mm-hmm. And these people are like doubling down on like shitty food,
right?
Yeah. Because they're fighting so hard against the vaccine thing. And yeah. It's kind of crazy to me. It's you have to be able to partition these things out. And if there's legitimate issues around the vaccine topic that people like me are missing, and fuck, man, hold my feet to the fire. Let's discuss that. Let's be really rigorous in it. But let's not throw literally the baby out with the bathwater with this other stuff.
Yeah.
And also, I've been critical of them going after things like natural flavors. It is just majoring in the minors. It is not the place that I think that the primary effort should be focused. But again, maybe this was part of a bigger plan. Maybe some base hit wins with that stuff led to some of these other, you know, potentially bigger wins.
Yeah.
Well, it's also just good politics. You can't do everything up front because by the time the election comes around, there's nothing left to do.
Right.
Right. And that's just a truth. It's just factual. When you start as a congressman, if you can get everything done in the first month, you go, that'd be great. But everyone will forget about it by the time I come up for re-election.
Yeah. Right.
And so the interests of politics is to do these step by step, carefully over time, and then test the water and
right.
see how it goes. Yeah. And okay, they accepted food dye ban. Okay, now we can go a little further. Those sorts of political decisions are inherent in the system. That's not something that they can change.
Right.
Secondly, that you mentioned that there's like a religion around this, right? And that's something that we talk about on our podcast all the time. That it's kind of cults all the way down. Like things are culture and cult is the same word. Right. And what we're talking about is our belief systems around these things can be that way. And it could be that way, especially about politics, right? Because it's the way we wield power. And so the fact that vaccine reform and diet is paired together in this way is a feature of politics that you have to learn how to navigate to coalition build to get the wins that you want.
Right.
Right. If you want any wins at all.
Yeah.
In the case of those folks is they got to now work with the vaccine skeptics in order to get something that they do want in. And it just takes that maturity to learn like, okay, I'm not going to like everything, but am I going to get a net good?
Yeah.
And accepting that and being willing to praise when you like it and criticize when you don't like it, that requires a political maturity. A lot of people who are caught in the cult can't deal with.
Right.
Right. Because they're too much bought into a singular worldview.
It makes me think of and I'm going to mention Trump. Oh my God. You know, I'm going to say something nominally favorable about the guy. So, oh my God.
Watch out.
But when
How
he was.
How dare you?
Thank you. Thank you. When he was being kind of interviewed about Kennedy and like, what do you think about him? He's like, well, I think he's spot on with all this health stuff. I'm not going to let him go after oil because Kennedy was probably going to kind of reef down on like oil exploration. I don't agree with a huge swath of his kind of environmental thinking. I would love to sit down with the dude for like an hour and run a whiteboard with him and just be like, what do you think of this? And I think I might be able to change his mind, you know, but Trump was pragmatic in that he's like, I really like what he's talking about on this health thing. And I think he's also good enough at reading the room that there was a big group of folks that were on board with that. So why not bring that coalition in? And he said, but we're not going to let Bobby go after that what do you call it, that liquid gold.
liquid gold.
And that seems pretty pragmatic. And all I would throw out there is like, do you really want to be less pragmatic than Donald Trump?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is he capable? Yeah. Is this kind of maniac that I wish it 90% of what he said and did didn't see the light of day. I think all of the world would be a better place. And there are a ton of people that are less pragmatic than he is.
Yeah.
And it makes me think of when Kennedy came out with the Tylenol during pregnancy. And then there are these videos of all these pregnant women just like downing Tylenol. And, yeah. For whatever, you know, if it's right or wrong. Why risk it?
Yeah, why?
But I'm just wondering if people are going to do similar videos of just downing giant bowls of pasta.
Just loaves of Wonder Bread.
Well, and again, I would love that, but I would love for them to be in a different insurance tranche than me. Yeah. It's like, you go be a chief, man, and let's watch that experiment.
Yeah. They're on Medicaid, yeah. Let's be honest. All right, so Maha just got a win, too. Like, that's the incredible thing, is the politics of this are in the favor of the good guys right now, right? Like, they just had a bill that would, or at least a part of a bill of an omnibus that would have removed liability for pesticide producers for the potential unintended consequences of it. Maha Action put out this tweet right here, pretty interesting. This was before, but this kind of shows like the activism worked. They removed this from the bill. I'm kind of ignorant of this, so I'm hoping that maybe you can explain it. Do you want to read it real quick, Joe, just so that sure. We can get the context?
Maha, we need your voice now. Big Chem is quietly pushing for pesticide immunity through Section 453 in a congressional spending bill. This would protect pesticide companies from accountability even when their products harm people. No company should be above the law. Call your congressional representatives and demand Section 453 be removed now.
Starting in the early 90s, use of the chemical pesticide glyphosate on our food supply began to skyrocket. Over the next 20 years, we saw an almost identical increase in the rates of bowel disease, thyroid cancer, renal disease, stroke, obesity, diabetes, and autism. We cannot let chemical companies have full immunity from causing health problems. Call your representatives now and tell them we must remove Section 453 from the House Appropriations Bill.
I'm sure it's just coincidence.
Well, that's a hell of a coincidence.
Well, you could overlay seed oils with that too, which I'm not as scared of seed oils as most people are. I think the problem is like just hyperpalatable foods are built with seed oils. You know, I've had these discussions with folks online. You take a Costco muffin, which is like 1,400 calories for a hockey puck size thing, and it's delicious. There's no way you're only going to eat like part of it. I'm like, are you really telling me that if we remove the canola oil and use tallow or butter, that this thing is going to become health food? And they're like, yes, you're nuts, you know? So you could overlay that. There's a lot, you know, correlation doesn't mean causation, and that's cool, but there should be some accountability on that stuff. And again, your mention of COVID and vaccines and everything in medicine, everything in life, Thomas Sowell, compared to what? Is it safe? Mm-hmm. Safe compared to what? Mm-hmm. At what cost? What cost? Roundup is kind of amazing. Like, it does some magical stuff. My father-in-law practically uses this stuff as like dental wash, you know, like, and his yard looks amazing. Mine looks like a jungle, but at what cost?
Yeah. Right.
You know, and there was a long period of time where producing enough food for the planet was the challenge. We landfill 50% of the food that's produced at this point now, mainly in the developed countries. But there's literally starvation, hunger is mainly a political issue these days. Like, if somebody isn't getting enough food, a country isn't getting enough food, it's usually a top-down kind of political issue, not a lack of the amount of food. So there's been some hand-wringing and concern around, can we produce enough food? It's really looking like we're going to end up with a plateau in total planetary population, so I don't think we're going to run out of the food to be able to feed people. Our biggest problem is folks overeating low-quality nutrient diets. And then if there is some sort of an underlying broad metabolic issue here that's causing a lot of expensive problems, then maybe we should address that and we should look into other more labor-intensive, you know, processes for making food. Joel Salatin, again, he has this line, we are unapologetic about our human inputs of food production. And even his like low-skilled workers get paid really well because they're out picking weeds and it sucks. But like, you either do that or you do the glyphosate thing. Right. Like there's, right. there's kind of, and I think that leaning into the regenerative agriculture angle and making it more decentralized and regional could really improve a lot of things. And maybe this major health factor here. And if we can't just ask the question, is there a risk-reward story that we're not comfortable with here? That's suspicious. Like any time that you could just give somebody complete political immunity and liability immunity, like the vaccine manufacturers and mm-hmm. whatnot, it's kind of like, what's going on there? Like yeah. if it's that valuable, they shouldn't. If it's that valuable and that safe, then it should stand up to scrutiny that we you know, there shouldn't be a problem
right.
here.
Well, it's really our avenue. Like lawsuits are really our avenue to have an adversarial system to discover the truth. That's what they are, right? When you look at the ability to confront an accuser of actual injury that you can measure and then have to present to a neutral third party, neutral, hopefully, a case about why this was caused, that is what a lawsuit is. Right. And so removing liability just removes your ability to have that discussion after the fact. And then for a long time, because of captured corporate interests, a lot of these things were just never really discussed or really put out in front of people to have the debate about, because it was just assumed that, well, I mean, it's signed off by the FDA, so therefore it must be safe. And there might not be other side effects, although we couldn't really measure everything. Right. So the degree to which we actually put the stamp of approval on up front is actually one of the major problems here. And it isn't even that, you know, we need to take off the stamp of approval. It's just that, you know, we need to encourage people. And I think the reversing the diet pyramid is part of the solution of saying, well, hey, glyphosate might be a problem, but should you really be having that many carbs anyways
right.
in the
right.
first place? What's right. the 80-20 principle there, as you're mentioning? Are we really hitting the board right? And there's an opportunity to say, well, we're going to keep the liability, right, in case there's a problem, and then we're going to encourage people to eat a healthy diet on top of that.
Yeah.
That seems like a total win from Maha's point of view and should be celebrated.
Yeah, you know? it's more of a philosophical question as opposed to maybe an exact ingredient question. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, sort of your position around seed oils, which I know are kind of a huge topic of conversation right now. Avocado oil and other non-seed oils, tallow, are becoming super popular. But I heard you answer a question of a listener on one of your podcasts saying basically if your diet isn't 80% processed, you know, wheat and things with you know, canola oil or whatever in them, that's the bigger problem than whether or not there's seed oils in a thing that you eat, right?
That's really my position. I've seen some folks that I like say like paleo, keto, carnivore scene. They'll go out and order a steak, and then they'll like bring the chef out, and they're like, "What oils do you use on the grill?" And they're like, "Canola oil," and they're like filleting this person there, and I'm like, "That is so not the point." Yeah. Like, are you eating that Costco muffin? Are you eating the Dorito? No. Well, then 95% of those problematic foods and the likelihood of overeating something has gone away. Mm. And worrying about the canola oil on the griddle versus coconut oil versus tallow, I think is majoring in the minors, and it terrorizes people. It makes them focus on the tiny minutiae instead of like the big picture. Did you lift weights this week? Did you go for a walk? Did you have a meaningful, like that's why jujitsu is great. Did you get a hug that made you pass out? Did you see people? Did your microbiome get exposed to different stuff? Like, did you get sun on your skin? Mm-hmm. Like those are all so much more important if you are already generally eating pretty well. And I think it's that majoring in the minors that it makes people neurotic and crazy. And then they just peel out because they're like, well, fuck it, I can't do any of this stuff.
Right.
You know, and
right.
it makes it unsustainable. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's really true. It's a holistic perspective as opposed to getting super narrowly focused on one pet issue and then changing your whole life around that and not going out to eat or whatever it is because you're afraid of canola oil.
Yeah.
I get that. And I guess to major in the majors, since you know some of these things are sort of smaller points in your worldview, like what is the biggest thing that you think people or maybe that Maha could do in the coming year to sort of push people more in the direction of thinking about the right things as opposed to focusing on the minutiae?
Oh man, that's a great question. I mean, sleep, good food, community, basic movement, sun on your skin, like if that can just a very basic, you know, kind of ancestral health lens, like you should be outside more. It's hard to do. Like I have as cush a life as you could get. And it's hard for me sometimes to just get outside, you know, because I'm doing a podcast. I do work. I'm running the kids around and stuff. But just being aware of that and trying to make some movement in that direction, making people aware, you know, why do we shift this food pyramid around? Again, this protein leverage hypothesis idea. Generally, when people eat a little more protein, they tend to eat fewer calories overall. Mm-hmm. It's just a general trend. And so you have a tendency to not overeat. Although epidemiological in nature, there's a really fascinating study that came out of Scandinavia that looked at all-cause mortality and relative amounts of sun exposure. And the group of, and it was in women, and the group of women that got more sun exposure had lower all-cause mortality on par with the difference between a pack-a-day smoking habit and not. So the people who got the least amount of sun were as unhealthy and died at a rate of people who had a pack-a-day smoking habit versus the gals who got more sun. And this isn't saying that you need to go out and become a leather handbag and you know, the super dark tan. It's just getting some sun outside. Right, and it's a profound effect.
Yeah.
You know, those are just kind of like take it to the bank things. A little bit of strength training, a little bit of cardio. Those things are easy. It has a cost associated with it, you know, whether you join a gym or but you can work out at home, you know, calisthenics.
Push-ups are free.
Push-ups and squats are free. Burpees are free, you know. You can do a lot, you know, because people always get wrapped around the axle of low-income or marginalized groups. It is hard. It's fucking hard. So let's empower them.
Yeah.
Let's tell them there's a million YouTube channels. And it's in Spanish and Italian and this and that. Like, yeah. Every language that you need, there's stuff there. There are people that will talk to you about, hey, yeah, you should go out and get some sun on your skin and have some community. I think if we had a broad, simple public health message, but, you know, other exercise folks usually sign off on, even the sunlight thing, though, it's like most doctors, particularly dermatologists, they're like, you should never have sun on your skin ever.
How crazy is that?
And it is insanity, you know? And
just walk around with an umbrella.
Jeez.
Just dip yourself in a vat of sunscreen, a bunch of cool chemicals in there. Yeah.
Some of these things, it's interesting. Some of the biggest movers, I guess the exercise is probably signed off on, community is signed off on. But like what I would call my approach to eating, it's like, it's too much fat, it's too much protein, it's unsustainable, it's all this stuff. And then this sleep, circadian biology, photo period thing, if you don't get out in the sun, if you don't have good circadian biology, then you don't sleep. Right. You don't sleep well. And the sleep hygiene is this huge thing that massively impacts health. And when short slept or poor slept, you are insulin resistant on par with a type 2 diabetic, and then your executive functioning is decreased. You tend to make worse decisions. Is this terrible downward spiral? Mm. I forget the entity, but it's recognized that shift work is understood to be a carcinogen because of the way it alters our metabolism. So I think that those are some big picture educational things that could really empower folks. It's like, and they don't have to pick a horse, you know, in the race. Do CrossFit, do Pilates, do this, do that, but do some of it outside, do some of it with people, do different things, get sun on your skin, try to make protein kind of like the first thing that you experience in a meal, and then some veggies, and if you want some carbs, have some carbs near the end. Just simply changing the order of eating a meal dramatically affects the glycemic index and then the insulin response, which then leads into how hungry you are later.
Great advice if you have kids
to
get them to eat better. Yeah. If you start out, the first thing on their plate is meat, and you have them eat that, and they're like, oh, and some vegetables, and then you go out with the carbs, and then you're going out with some fruit, and by the end of the time they get there, they're full, they're not going to eat as much carbs. I've done that since the very beginning with my kids, and it's so helpful. I think I got that advice from you or somebody else.
I call it the speed bump method.
Yeah.
You're just putting – so if you think about like click funnels for trying to sell things, every time there's another interface, another click, you tend to cut participation in half. Mm-hmm. You can flip that on its head with behavior change. If you start with the protein and then the veggies and then the low glycemic load starches, and then it's like, oh, you want to – piece of chocolate or some cake or something, go for it. Because they're like, it's going to be a small piece and then they're totally good. Mm-hmm. And my kids at 13 and 11, I don't police their food really at all at this point, But we always have a protein option, some veggies, and then some starches. And we always have some sort of a desserty thing floating around. They're there. But the only thing is, I'm like, I really want you to start with the protein and then work your way through. Mm-hmm. And they're 95% good with that. I don't have to police their food at all. And what's crazy, we started doing family pizza night Friday nights. And we were doing that for a while. And then both kids, they were like, hey, Dad, could you like grill some chicken or some steak or something so I can have some protein with it? I don't feel good only eating pizza. I'm like, yeah, of course.
I mean, I bet you that just made you a proud dad.
Awesome. Right? Yeah, yeah. Because I think so many people are like, you're going to give your kids eating disorder and all this stuff. And I don't want to do that. That is a real thing. There's the like Catholic schoolgirl thing where it's kind of like they get free and then they go crazy.
Yeah.
I didn't want that either. And so I've just tried to talk to them and educate them about this stuff and let them empirically experience this. And I tell them all the time, you're going to be able to make the decisions 100% on your own. My hope is that you're able to learn from this stuff. Like both your grandparents died at 70 from horrible metabolic issues. Don't want that for you.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's worked pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. And that's good. I think that these are relatively easy things that people can enact, and then they can empirically just like, yeah, I do feel better. I don't get that afternoon energy slump. I'm not hangry and starving because I had a meal of only oatmeal or like cereal or something, and I'm starving 2 hours later.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that actually segues really well into a question we got from a member of our Discord community. Zernitic asked, what are your thoughts on the nutrition level in raw vegetables today? I've heard mentioned that it's down compared to previous decades, but haven't looked into the detail.
Yeah.
And this sort of relates to soil health in a way, right?
Yeah. It's interesting, like some of the methods, a couple of things, the soil tends to get degraded over time. When you grow something in the soil, you don't really, it takes a while to think about this, but when a thing is growing there and then you remove the thing, you literally mined stuff out of the soil. Mm-hmm. And if you don't replenish it, then it's gone or you're depleting it. And this is where rotational planting is something that was developed within all kinds of different agricultural regions around the world, because they would notice that an area would be productive and then it would fail. And then people notice, oh, if I put manure in it, and, you know, different things. So you have like nitrogen, then you have the minerals and whatnot. What's fascinating is the use of regenerative agriculture, and you can't do it everywhere all the time, but where you can interface like a grassland with the agricultural products that you are producing, grassroots go feet, meters below the ground, mm-hmm. and there's a symbiotic interface between bacteria and fungi in the soil, where the plant will feed them a little bit of glucose, and then those organisms mine minerals out of the soil. Hmm. And so if you can let an area go fallow for a period of time, have animals on it, grow that perennial grass, and then go back in and farm it and rotate through that, it's a way that you can continue to reestablish a soil nutrient health. It's a lot of work. It's not as immediately productive and economically viable as just like extracting every last little you know, erg out of the thing. Mm-hmm. But at some point that cropland fails and we damage the soil. Alan Savory has made the case that the greatest export that the United States produces is its topsoil, because it just blows away in the wind and goes down the rivers. And when it's gone, it's kind of gone. Like it takes a long time to replenish that. Yeah. So I do think that the nutrient deficiency story, like in fruits and vegetables, is legit. I'm not entirely sure what to do about it, because it's kind of like that still is probably the best game in town.
In terms of, you know, buying vegetables at
the grocery store. What else are you going to eat? Right. You know, if you can find like a local farm, maybe they do some permaculture and stuff like that. Maybe it's more nutrient dense. I do think that this is where like leaning into some things like seafood, like sardines, oysters, stuff like that, they're shockingly nutrient dense and tend to be high in some of these minerals that we don't get. Berries tend to be quite good. So I think, again, like if you, I'm this shill for like the paleo diet thing, but Lauren Cordain had a paper, and I'm completely blanking on the name of it, but it basically compared a 2000 calorie diet with kind of standard agricultural products versus like a paleo diet. And it looked like you were taking a nutritional supplement with the paleo diet. It was like 500% of this. The only thing it was deficient in was calcium and vitamin D, which you would kind of make sense. You get vitamin D from the sun, ideally, if you can get it. But there's other ways to get that. And then the calcium, I would also make the case that if you're getting adequate magnesium, you don't need to get as much calcium, and that's probably where that plugs in. And also, Cordain was very against dairy products. I'm not really against dairy products, as long as you handle them. And if you have a modicum of dairy here and there, then it addresses the calcium. Mm-hmm. But it's absolutely shocking the difference in nutritional profile if you've got a really grain-heavy 2,000-calorie diet versus meat, seafood, fruits, vegetables, root shoots, and tubers. Like, you can't even compare the two.
Yeah.
So I just think you have to stack the deck in your favor and eat these more nutrient-dense foods.
Mm-hmm. The regenerative agriculture thing is a really incredible movement. There's a part in the documentary that on Sacred Cow. It's on Amazon Prime, so check it out, where they actually have this area that's like kind of desert, of turning into
a Chihuahuan desert.
Yeah. It was fascinating. And watching them run cattle over it, the cattle poop on the ground, and that like regenerates the soil, starts growing grass. That was amazing. And it seems
all
like
the birds,
a solution to one of our biggest problems is like the runoff and water retention and making sure that our ground is good so that we can grow stuff on it. Now, that there was some talk about that being going into some kind of policy or something like that when Trump first came to office. I know you're more familiar with this than I am. But
yeah, I know there was like, I think Joel Salatin made a tweet or something at the time about being involved in the USDA in some way. Mm-hmm. And then that didn't happen as far as I'm aware. But yeah, I mean, I would hope that something would come of that, and bringing regenerative agriculture into the sort of the policy conversation at the national level. I don't exactly know what that would look like. I mean, what would you like to see in terms of supporting regenerative ag from the administration?
I would love to see a federal policy to support state and local level interventions, because what you do in Montana is going to be totally different than Nevada, just at like an implementation level. Yeah. Like, I don't know, we're not riparian habitat. We might be high desert in Bozeman. I'm not sure technically what we are. But you just what you do on the ground at a given location is so different spot to spot. I would be really careful about any type of broad mandates from the top. I would really support people at the local level to get in and develop that stuff. But yeah, but there's a 1940s, 1930s movie called The Sea of Grass, Ocean of Grass. Mm. And it's talking about the former grassland that extended from Las Vegas all the way up to Salt Lake City.
Huh.
Like, it used to be like chest high grass.
Wow.
And it's a desert now.
Yeah.
And it's sage and a lot of these plants like that, acacia in Texas. These are indicative of grassland that got overgrazed and then it got damaged. And this is kind of like the succession that occurs. And this is one of these things that's really hard for folks to figure out, is that you can overgraze an area, you can undergraze an area. And grasslands co-evolved with herbivorous animals over millions of years, and they both need these things. They need fire occasionally for some of them. Mm-hmm. And it is interesting. Bison tend to do a really good job in a lot of these areas. Bison are very difficult to manage relative to cows. Like, we have friends in the Polson area that run bison, the Roam Free Bison Ranch, and they want to kill you, you know? And you can't just use bison for all this stuff, even though they used to be kind of like the climax species in a lot of these areas. Cattle can be used, but the overfeeding or overgrazing, undergrazing thing is interesting. If you just let cattle do what they want to do, they'll go eat specifically the things they want, and then they'll circle back around. So if you think about like 20 head of cattle in like a 200-acre pasture, they will eat the things that they like, and then they will leave. And then as that stuff starts growing again, they'll eat that again. And that's where they will destroy perennial grasses. Mm. When you mob graze, you use either predator interaction, like the pressure of like wolves and coyotes to keep animals bunched together, and they eat everything because they stay together in a pack and they pee and they poo. And then they leave and they don't come back for some period of time. You can replicate that with portable electric fencing. And this is where folks at Alan Savory, lots of other folks, go into an area that's desertified. They apply these animals to the area, remove them. And then as things start coming back, they reintroduce them at a later cadence. And It I guess the best explanation that I have for it or analogy is grazing is like exercise for grassland. Mm. You want the right dose. You don't want too little. You don't want too much. It'd be the kind of vegan, vegetarian oriented environmental groups don't want any grazing to occur at all. And their thought is to return it to natural landscape, which natural landscape is involved grazing animals. And part of this is because they're vegan and vegetarian. They don't want animals being eaten at all. But ironically, it's just as injurious to the land as overgrazing. Mm-hmm. It's like both of them will absolutely crush a given landscape. Hmm.
That's fascinating. And I know that, yeah, on this topic, they're like one of the main objections that I hear from, you know, sort of the environmental side or maybe the vegan vegetarian side is that, you know, okay, maybe regenerative agriculture could help the environmental impact of the concentrated feeding operations, but there's not enough land out there for, you know, there to be enough cattle grazed to feed everyone that we have to feed in the world. Like, is that something that you've heard? How would you address?
Oh yeah, we definitely dug into that in Sacred Cow. Depending on the location, so like Joel Salatin is in this great area of Virginia where they will get a winter, but it's not like a super hard freeze. It's not like here. They'll get some snow. But arguably, they're kind of growing grass year-round, and it's very moist. It's very lush. But the way he runs his cattle, he gets 5 times more cow days per year than his neighbors. And it's kind of funny because he's been surrounded by people like, you know, for 60 years and they still don't do the shit that he does. You know, he's way more successful than they are. But because of the location he's in, he's able to produce 5 times more food on a given patch of dirt than the conventional approaches. Hmm. Someplace like here where it's drier, it might be 50% more, it might be 25% more. You can produce a remarkable amount of food on marginal land if it's well managed. And there's just huge tracts of land that we just don't use. Right. So the "we don't have enough land" thing is kind of like, I don't even know. One, it's really not true. And then the other side of it is like, well, let's just produce as much food as we can while renutrifying the soil and improving the water capture. So like all these water tables that are depleting, it will improve that because instead of the water just running off, it actually soaks into the ground. Mm-hmm. So if we really lean into that, I don't know how much total food we can produce, but you can produce a lot of food. And then we need to figure out what else we do. And there's an interesting paper about the least harm principle that was produced out of University of Oregon ages ago. And it actually broke down how many critters are killed like in conventional grain, legume, you know, base production versus like basically cows. It's so funny because it's literally like paleo. It's like cows, potatoes, sweet potatoes, fruits, vegetables, and it ends up being a tiny fraction the number of animals killed. Because if you go like mammal for mammal, a cow and a mouse are different sizes, but they're similar complexity, you know? And so you end up killing far fewer animals with this regenerative kind of intervention. So even at the least harm level, you end up winning there. Like if you really buy into the reducing suffering and all that type
of
stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
And you get healthier people. Great food,
and you get healthier people and healthier planet.
They kind of count too, right?
Yeah.
You know? Additionally, that this is something that we discover. It's a man of system error, right? If you just assume, oh, we don't have enough land, I've done the calculation, you know, whatever, the numbers don't actually tell you what you need to know, which is the on-the-ground information. As you're saying, you can put more cattle on less land in the east than maybe you can in the mountain northwest. These things are solved on the ground through discovery. What we need is a sufficient amount of education about the advantages, and then we can go out and discover how much we can produce on the ground. And that because it's something that you operate on the margin to, like, oh, I can do this much more on this property if I implement it based upon the localized information.
That is a great point. And the reason why we don't have more discovery locally is because it's almost impossible to process your meat locally. Mm-hmm. Mm. It's devilishly hard to do it. The USDA, FDA have a choke point on processing. And Thomas Massie had the Prime Act, which was basically making a case for like, local butcher shops and even restaurants are fully capable of processing animals and oftentimes do, but then you're very, very limited in where that food can go. Mm. And when you overlay like the possibility of like some blockchain and stuff like that, this is always couched in like food safety and all yeah. that. And we did have Upton Sinclair in the jungle and like rats getting canned and mm-hmm. those days are gone,
yeah.
you know? And
yeah.
so like we can shift gears now. We maybe should eat more of the food that's produced locally, eat it locally.
Right.
Like almost none of the beef that is produced in Montana is consumed in Montana. It's yeah. shipped elsewhere. And there's lots of places like that. But a ton of different mechanisms have gone into this consolidation within food production. And so you don't have that local level discovery of like, well, what does work? Maybe we should do sheep and cows here. Maybe we do actually do bison in this area. Like bison are great for very hilly areas, which is why our friends out in Polson, cows don't do great on that because they won't go up hills. Whereas like bison love being on mountainous hilly areas because they can see predators coming in mm-hmm. and they are indifferent as to what they eat. They eat everything, you know, mm-hmm. particularly if you are pestering them a little bit. And so they'll get out on motorcycles. It's crazy. Like the bison will ram Polaris and side-by-sides and stuff like that. But a dude on a dirt bike, they're like terrified. Whoa. Of them. It's weird. I'm like, yeah, it's crazy. I wouldn't want to do that. But they'll move them around, you know, and get some of that predator-prey interaction. And they're able to take what is otherwise regarded as very marginal land and get great utility out of it. Mm-hmm. And so this is stuff that normally it's like, that's not usable for beef. And it's like, well, maybe it's usable for bison and maybe it would be usable. Then you can like hybridize beef and bison. So you get some of the characteristics of both, or they're not quite as murderous and, you know, stuff like that. So there are so many untapped solutions out there on this food production side, but a lot of it's difficult to access because of the really tight margins in food production and because of the tendency to aggregate it up to larger and larger levels.
Yeah,
right.
And a lot of that is because of the local and state rules, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't until just a couple of years ago that Montana had any amount of food freedom. We couldn't mm-hmm. sell raw milk here. We couldn't do a lot of stuff. A bill passed that gave us some more freedom for your local grocer, your local butcher to actually service their customers
yeah.
fully, but they still have to deal with federal regulations, which are one of the reasons why we have such a consolidated meatpacking market.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And of course, you know, when the solution come from DC a couple of years ago was, well, we'll just have government meatpacking market organizations sure or subsidize the government, the existing ones.
Just imagine the post office, but with beef instead of packages.
Right. Rather than letting off the gas of the safetyism and the progressivism that says, oh, we got to control everything and everything would be safe. That's the problem now. So now we got to go the other direction. We overcorrected. Now we got to go back the other way and say, well, no, we're going to trust people on the ground that they're not going to poison their consumers because they don't want to poison their consumers. They want to help them.
Yeah. Right? I mean, with the internet and whatnot, like if 10 people get food poisoning from an outfit, that's going to be well understood and it's mm-hmm. going to be really negatively impactful for those folks. And, yeah. and, yeah, like having some faith in this is one of the rare things that like some sort of social media presence plus like a blockchain to document this thing came from this place could right. be really good.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think the blockchain idea is really interesting. Can you unpack that a little bit more? So like your blockchain coding, like per cow,
per cow.
Origin,
so you can trace exactly the origin. Yeah. So right now, because
it's a whole different kind of brand, you know, just like,
yeah.
It's QR code.
QR code, stamp of the year, that sort of thing.
So like if you go to a Costco and get one of their packages of pretty good quality, like grass fed ground beef, there may be up to 600 cows in that. Like it's a massive number of them. Wow. In the butchering of those cows, yeah, deal with some gnarly things like the intestines and whatnot. Where this becomes problematic is if you nick a part of the intestine, then feces can get on it, and that can make it into thousands, tens of thousands of pounds of food. If you're processing this stuff at more of a one-off level and documenting that, if that one cow is mishandled, it's a much more local, small issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is some of the benefit of potentially plugging that blockchain in. There are economies of scale, like doing the way that they do this stuff and in mass, there is some remarkable efficiencies associated with it. But I think that we could I think there's some give and take on that stuff. Mm. You know, like if it's more like the sleeve of meat that you get is mainly one cow and that thing's got a chain of custody that goes back into the blockchain, then if there is a problem, it's very easy to track that back down. You can look at best practices, you know, plug the holes in that. And I think also, you know, it's limiting the problem or the mistake to a smaller spot versus mm-hmm. it being, you know, every once in a while you hear 10,000 pounds of meat, you know, destroyed because of a mistake or, mm-hmm. you know, contamination mm-hmm. or what have you. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we got a couple other from the Discord and we got to let you go. We're running. This has been a lot of fun. I've lost track of time.
I can go however long you guys want to go. Oh, okay. So yeah. Yeah.
So this is, our Irishman. I'm curious about the nutritional difference for humans of corned beef versus grass-fed beef.
Corn-fed.
Oh, not corned. Corned.
I was like, why'd you just call him an Irishman? That's from my brother, Sam.
It was a joke. Okay. It's a joke. Gotcha. He's our local Conor McGregor.
He is.
It's better to have grass-fed cows, but what does the corn do to the cow specifically?
It's a really good question, and something to unpack north of that is that even your standard conventional cattle that end up in a CAFO lot, 70% of their life is spent on grass. Mm. They just get finished on grains and whatnot. And then even mixed within that, a ton of what's not considered grass finished is like putting cows into there was a wheat field that was harvested and they eat crop residue, which is great because they take all that cellulosic material and that we cannot break down that would either oxidize or compost of its own accord. You can either make food with it or not. So there's lots of great efficiencies with that. What you generally see, you know, with legit corn-fed beef is that it tends to be higher in fat broadly, higher in saturated fats, more specifically, lower in omega-3s, maybe a little lower in some nutrients. If you find some animals that are on like spring clover and they get harvested then, it's very, very different because like the fat will be orange. Like all those carotenoids that are in the forage are like in there. Wow. And it's remarkable. You can't do that everywhere all the time. And this is again where like some of the paleo carnivore scene, like they because they've never raised an animal. Like I'm not like a rancher, but I've raised a lot of animals now because I've been involved with this stuff. You can have massive variation, particularly a place like Montana. Overwintering, like you kind of got to do what you got to do. It's kind of like hay and silage and stuff like that. And the nutritional profile, and you're probably going to do some grains with it for the caloric density. It's going to have a different nutritional profile than an animal that's on like spring pasture. It just will. But it still is orders of magnitude more nutrient dense than like any kale, broccoli, spinach or grains and whatnot. This is one of the things, and Diana really did the grunt work on this. People will get wrapped around the axle of the omega-3 content of pastured meat. It has more omega-3s in pastured meat, grass-fed meat, than it does in grain-fed meat. But you would need to eat 8 pounds of pastured meat to get the same amount of omega-3s as you get in like a 4-ounce piece of salmon. Hmm. And so like that's not really the place to go looking for omega-3s, right, just right. broadly. So mm-hmm. it's I love the idea of pastured animals, but you have to have some pragmatism to it. Like there are just
it tastes different too. Like if it's grass fed all the way through, it tastes a little bit more like an elk or a bison like that. It just doesn't taste the way you expect it to. And if that's a barrier for you, it's better to have a steak than to just have a pizza instead. You know what I mean? Like don't make that trade-off that way. Think about it like, well, I'm going to maximize, but if it's really better to just have a steak, just do that. Just even if it's grass
grain fed or whatever. Yeah, without a doubt. And it's one of those things again where I think folks make perfection the enemy of good enough. Mm. And it's like, we just need to be pragmatic about this stuff. We have all of all this material that gets landfilled, and instead of there's an outfit in New Mexico, I forget the name of the outfit, but they raise pigs there, and they've plugged into the local supermarkets and restaurants, and they provide these places with bins. Hmm. And the restaurant will scrape all their food, you know, leftovers into it. And then these guys come around like every couple of days and collect them. They autoclave all this food, basically heat it, pressure cook it, and then feed it to the pigs. So it's not like pasture. It's not this. It's not that. But when people get wrapped around the axle of like the sustainability of food systems, poultry and pork are 100% grain and soy based, 100%. Yeah. And whereas like cattle are at least ostensibly, you could 100% grass feed them and then use like crop residues and rest not. But a minimum is 70% of their life is on grass. Mm. We just landfill all kinds of food that could go into things like pork production. Mm-hmm. But there's typically laws against it. It's super hard to be able to do that stuff. Mm. So there's some really interesting efficiencies that could be done if we didn't have these kind of onerous laws. And it's always it's a question like, do you want a pig farm down the street from you? Probably not. Like they smell a lot. This is one of these difficult things too. Yeah. And like large scale chickens and whatnot. But if we want a more integrated food system, these are some of the trade-offs that we have to do. Joel Salatin, he has this, the Rackin House. It's a rabbit chicken house. And so they have rabbits in cages up above, and they feed them like grass clippings and all this stuff. And then the rabbits poo and the chickens run around below and kick up the pick through that and pick through the grubs that are in it and everything. And Joel made the case that like every cul-de-sac in a suburban situation, if one person were to take like the lawn clippings that aren't glyphosate, imbued and plugged it in this Rackin house, you could have rabbit and chicken for that whole cul-de-sac. Hmm. And it was just like that person decided to take on like this cottage industry thing and do it. Huh. But it's typically illegal. Like all the HOAs are illegal and stuff like that. Oh, yeah. You go to places like Southeast Asia and you see things like this, where one person kind of does this and the local community will provide a bunch of like leftover food inputs and whatnot that they give to the chickens or the pigs or what have you. So when people kind of get wrapped around the axle of we can't produce enough food doing these other things, they have no idea what they're talking about. Like there's so many interesting, innovative ways of producing food at a more local level. Versus like it kills me. I see people mow their lawn and they bag up the grass in a fucking trash bag and pitch it. And you're just like,
kills good for your lawn, man. Mulch it.
So at least mulch it because the nutrients go back in. But, so maybe just mulch it. But there are these other things where you could do these kind of fascinating alternate food production things. And what's funny is they used to not be alternate. They were like mandatory. Like if you were going to live, you did all of this stuff because you had to extract all of the nutrition and the energy density out of the environment around you. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we find ourselves in such a comfortable state with all the modern amenities and everything that we don't have to do that stuff. And so then it gets outlawed by the HOA because it's a nuisance. No one wants chickens or whatever, smelling up the cul-de-sac, right?
Right. Right.
Wasn't there an example in the book that I think it was in Ireland, pigs were used for getting rid of human waste?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's all across Northern Europe. It's common practice throughout the Middle Ages. Yeah.
Which is kind of gnarly.
Don't love that. Yeah. No. Yeah.
But, very efficient. You got to get that creative folks. Doubt.
All right. Last question for you, Rob, and then we'll get you out of here because we know you got a lot going on in your life. This is from Emily. She says, I'm curious about paleo versus ketogenic approaches when the primary goal is brain health. From your perspective, are there cognitive or neurological trade-offs people should be aware of with either approach over the long term?
Oh, man, that's a great question. I think it's going to depend on the person. Like some people really seem to respond particularly well to keto. And like the ketones as an alternate primary fuel source for the brain just seem to be super beneficial, again, for some people. My wife's an interesting example where she's very metabolically flexible. Like she'll eat a pretty good size a carbohydrate meal and her blood sugar barely changes. She'll eat ketogenic and she doesn't even notice the transition, whereas most people, it feels like hitting a bug against a windshield type thing. So I think it's going to be dependent on the person. Ketosis broadly tends to be anti-inflammatory. It reduces the inflammasome, like the total inflammatory process within the body. Seems to be neuroprotective, but but just simply preventing really big blood sugar excursions like highs and lows, which a basic paleo approach could do that too, because you're eating good amount of protein, good amount of fat, lower glycemic load carbohydrates. Even within that, if you're eating a lot of fermentable fiber, you produce butyrate, which is very similar to beta-hydroxybutyrate from ketosis. So there's an argument to be made that you're probably introducing, you know, a good amount of caloric volume from butyrate products and propionate products that are metabolically similar. But I think it just depends on the person to some degree. I think like that basic paleo template just is a little, I think, a little easier to do. The broader the approach, the easier I think it generally is. Although the case to be made, if it's too broad, then you get yourself in trouble. And so like you may need some specific lane lines. I've historically felt better on keto than even paleo, even though I was kind of like the paleo guy. But it's funny, after I had a really terrible 7 years of gut issues. I had a giardia, a roundworm, and candida overgrowth that was killing me. And we figured this out about a year ago. I went through treatment for it. And fascinatingly, now I do better with probably about 100 grams of carbs a day versus like that 30 or 40 grams that I was at for ages. I seem to do better with some fermentable fiber. I do a little bit of beans. I do a little bit of cold rice and stuff like that. Again, 100 grams of carbs a day is not a lot. Oftentimes people are doing 100 grams of carbs in a meal. So yeah, like I'm still eating on the lower carb side, particularly with my physical activity. But this is something that has profoundly changed for me. Mm. Like I usually have noticed better cognition and energy levels and whatnot on a stricter ketogenic diet. But now that my gut is healthy, like I feel a little better with a little more carbs.
Yeah.
And so I think even that, you know, can change depending on what your situation is. If you have some dysbiosis, then you might need keto or carnivore or something. But I don't think the goal – there are some people in this scene that make it's like an Olympic sport, how limited their diet can be. And like, I only eat beef. Well, I only eat grass-fed beef from this place, you know, and it's like this arms race around that. And to me, if you need to do that to live, okay. Mm. Yeah. People like Michaela Peterson,
the lion diet and everything.
Yeah. Like that's her option, you know, and she's pushed at the edges and tried to do other things. She gets sick every time. And I got to say, I had 15 years of that. I really poked at the edges too. Luckily, and knock on wood, every day I wake up and I'm a little healthier. I'm kind of like, fuck, that's really, really cool, you know? But I don't think the goal should be like the most limited diet that you could get. Mm. You know, it's a sign of not being resilient. And resilience is that you can experience a stress and come back stronger as a consequence. Mm. And so like, I like people to do elimination diets so they can figure out if they have like some allergies or different things. But then you should reintroduce things and just kind of poke at the margins. And if you have too big of a carb meal and you feel like shit and you're hungry again, you're hangry after that, it's like, okay, I understand where my lane lines are. But you've at least mapped that out instead of just trying to get more and more and more constrained in the way that you eat, which I don't think it's good for mental health. It's difficult to do long term. If the only option that you have because you're legit super sick, like I was, and I was down to like fatty red meat that was pastured and that was it. But my life sucked. Like I didn't like doing that. I like having a little bit of gluten-free bread and some sweet potato and stuff like that. Like after having had to eat that way for like 5 years because I was going to die otherwise. And now it's kind of like I can have a little bit of gluten-free bread here and there. So, oh my God, this is amazing, you know?
Yeah.
No, I think variety is the spice of life, right?
Yeah,
so why limit it unless you have to?
Unless you have to. And and I will, that does get slippery because again, like that, the 7-Eleven thing, like we have so much variety. It's very easy to get yourself into a bad situation where you're eating, you go from one thing to the next, and it's easy to overeat. But if we circle back around to like, some protein, some veggies, some fat, then throw in your bread, rice, pasta at the end of that, you usually do pretty good with it.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, yeah. Rob, thank you so much for joining us today.
Honored to bring down property values. So I'll do it anytime you guys want to.
Nonsense. Yeah, that was a good time. All you do is bring down Element, and we'll have you.
Okay, easy. Easy.
Yeah, so make sure to check out your website.
The only thing I'm doing these days is Substack for the most part, and I'll push that out to social, and I think it's robwolf.substack.com or substack.robwolf.com. Yeah. I forget.
We'll put in the link. Okay. We'll put in the show notes. Definitely drink Element, stay salty, enjoy yourself. And if you can't find it at your local convenience store or something like that, bother them about it. Be like, hey, I want some Element.
It's coming. We're in Walmart and Target nationally. We're in Costco Canada, I think, now nationally. So, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Getting the Canucks some hydration.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah. Good. All right. Maybe we'll be less angry.
Yeah. Awesome. Rob, thank you so much, man.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.